listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Speaking to other people, especially when you're talking about potentials of war and death, and famine, and lots of other things, you meet.
That was President Donald Trump Monday, after being asked by a reporter if he would be willing to meet with Iran's President Hassan Rouhani.
There's nothing wrong with meeting. We met, as you know, with Chairman Kim, and you haven't had a missile fired off in 9 months. We got our prisoners back. So many things have happened, so positive. But meeting with people, I had a great meeting, in my opinion. Of course, the fake news didn't cover it that way, but I had a great meeting with President Putin of Russia. I think it was a great meeting in terms of the future, in terms of safety and economic development and protecting Israel and protecting everybody. I thought it was a great meeting. Great meeting with NATO. I just explained NATO. Hundreds of billions of dollars more money will be paid into NATO, the coffers of NATO. And much already has. So I believe in meeting. I would certainly meet with Iran if they wanted to meet. I don't know that they're ready yet. They're having a hard time right now. But I ended the Iran deal. It was a ridiculous deal. I do believe that they will probably end up wanting to meet. And I'm ready to meet anytime they want to. And I don't do that from strength or from weakness. I think it's an appropriate thing to do. If we could work something out that's meaningful, not the waste of paper that the other deal was, I would certainly be willing to meet.
Do you have preconditions for that meeting?
No preconditions, no. They want to meet, I'll meet, anytime they want.
Today we discussed the idea of President Trump as a peace president with Professor Tony Montero. We caught up with him live in Philadelphia and spoke with him via Skype Thursday. Professor Montero, it's a pleasure to have you with us. Let's start with this article you pointed me to in the Financial Times.
Okay, let me first of all say that for people who are really interested in dissecting and understanding this moment in history, I would encourage them to read the Financial Times. One of the conclusions that I drew from the article, although the author doesn't say it, is that Trump, in essence, rejects the concept of the unipolar world.
Yep.
Dominated by the United States. And what the author then says is that in the end, China benefits from Trump's policies of economic and military pullback from the idea of a unipolar world or a single hegemon, which is another way of saying, Don, what we have been trying to say over these many months, that by rejecting the unipolar world, Donald Trump, ironically, is pursuing a path of non-aggression. I refer to him as the most pro-peace president since Kennedy.
Yep.
And it's all over the better analyses that we find, for example, in the Financial Times, such an essay, such an opinion piece, you would never find, never in the New York Times or the Washington Post or the LA Times or on CNN or anywhere else in the corporate media of this country. So it's very fascinating what they're seeing. And what the author also sees is that China has assumed that the 21st century will not be the century like the 20th, will not be the century of the Atlantic, but it will be the century of the Pacific,
right,
which is another way of saying it is the century of Asia.
Right.
Asia will be the pivot of economic development, and I would add technological development.
Right. You know, there's an interesting thing at work here when you talk about the Financial Times, and this was also true, still to a degree, but before Murdoch particularly bought the Wall Street Journal, of the Wall Street Journal. And that is not the part that's out there for the rubes, for public discussion, but when you see analysis by the bourgeoisie of things, their analysis is probably among the most rigorous Marxist analysis of events all. Because, as it turns out, Marx is right. They know it. And they're saying, okay, well, so what, despite what we think is going on, what's actually going on, so we can figure out how to stay here in the big chair or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so you see this article that you referenced in Financial Times says, one for all his let's be nice mood, etc., Trump is progressively dismantling the pillars of the U.S.-led international order. Mm-hmm. One way or another, the president has undermined the U.S. commitments to climate change, nuclear nonproliferation, NATO, the EU, longstanding relationships with Japan and South Korea. No one can tell that he won't tear up tomorrow NAFTA or pull U.S. troops out of the Middle East. Says right. The credibility and trust on which U.S. power was built is draining away. Now, I don't know about that, because that assumes a bunch of willing, players that are equals, and I see it more, an empire from top down. What it does do is show the people who've been following instructions that maybe there's some room for them to jump off of the strings. And there's things like we saw, and I mentioned this when the campaign was going on with NATO, when he was making a demand that the other countries pony up 2% of their GDP, I saw that as undermining NATO.
No question.
Because the reality of it is that if you go into all of these European countries that have austerity budgets in place for the last 10 years and say we now have to give the United States another 1% of our GDP for NATO, they'll be in the street saying, bye-bye, NATO.
Right. That's right.
And that's the dynamic here in general.
That's right. And first of all, we have to acknowledge that in the United States, we live under the most brutal form of the dictatorship of financial capital, the most the greatest authoritarian control of thought and sources of information,
yep,
from social media up to the New York Times and the rest of them.
Yep.
I mean, this is the most brutal form of the dictatorship of finance capital of any country in the world, of any regime perhaps in history.
Yep.
Let's acknowledge that.
For sure.
Now, Trump was elected as a rogue, as an outsider,
that's right,
as a candidate, a politician challenging the form of the dictatorship of finance capital,
yep,
both domestically and in international relationships.
Yep.
And he knows what the Europeans have known for decades. You cannot afford what we call the welfare state in a time of shrinking economic power and domination of Europe and America. You cannot afford the welfare state and the warfare state at the same time.
That's right.
And when Trump says that he will turn, as he said in 2016, he will turn the Republican Party into a workers' party, that didn't mean necessarily a socialist party,
right,
but a party sensitive and so on to the interests of working people broadly conceived.
Right.
Now, that is a statement of aspiration. It is not a statement of how you do that. There's right, a lot to debate around that. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at what he is doing in foreign policy, the actual retreat from, or setting up a retreat from NATO, this is huge,
yep,
because NATO is the spearhead of Euro-American aggression in most of the world, including Afghanistan,
yep,
including Libya, including Syria, including the Ukraine, including the Baltic states. I mean, come on.
Yep. And it's going to be the, you know, the entity that engages in World War III with Russia, should that come to pass.
And absolutely.
And that's actually its organizing principle.
Absolutely.
You know, and
NATO is but a cover for U.S. militarism.
Right. Yep.
You know what I'm saying? And
yep,
so when Trump attacks NATO, the Germans understand immediately what it means.
Yeah.
And then they have to come to terms with a reality where the U.S. is no longer supporting 100% the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And that's what they're trying to adjust to. Or to the reality that they cannot, the Germans, I'm using as an instance,
right,
they cannot have it both ways. They cannot both be economic friendly to Russia through the pipelines for gas, natural gas, and so on, and at the same time claim to be on the side of U.S., former U.S. policy in NATO. You can't have it both ways. I think the German people, the Germans, who are not were not brought up on this idea of war in the post-war period. In fact, they were re-educated against it. I think the German people and German politicians will choose friendly economic relations with Russia and China over having, and I put quotes, a strong NATO. This is a new reality. They frankly, you know, Merkel has a friend or a fellow traveler in Trump. The German
That's
people
right,
who don't want war in Europe have a friend in Trump. And I think Trump's rhetoric, and I'll end on this, Trump's rhetoric about you need to up your contributions to NATO and your military budgets to 2% of your GDP, or he even went further and said 4%. I
right,
think he was saying, in effect, look, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization is unaffordable for Europeans and it's unaffordable for the United States. So let's begin the process of dismantling it.
I mean, in support of what you just said, again, Trump's own words, and you made reference to it, at the same time that he was there on a NATO trip, he was saying to the Germans, you know, you got to buy more fracked expensive gas and oil from us and less from Russia, which is conveniently delivered through pipelines and, you know, easy to extract and much cheaper. In other words, you have to sacrifice your economy, not just by writing a check for 2 or 4% or whatever, but by making your decisions about your economic necessities on what's good for us and not what's good for your economic sense, which is a harder sell. And he said it out loud. It's one thing if you're saying that in the back room. You know, if he had a two-hour conversation with Merkel and only a translator, you know, the press wouldn't be worried about that at all. Yeah. Trump should worry about it because, you know, Merkel may come out of the meeting and say, oh, he hit on me or whatever. And who knows what the media would do then. But the reality is that if he went into a meeting like that and made these kinds of demands on Germany and then you saw this kind of process play out afterwards and somebody dared to mention that essentially Trump bullied Merkel in a meeting, the media, they could care less. But this is the reality of the relationship with the U.S. with all of these players, Japan, Korea. You know, when we talk about Korea, we're talking about the U.S. ultimately pulling out of Korea and allowing Korea to be itself, which hasn't been allowed to do that since the 1930s. You know, if you spread that across the world, you are talking about a reconfiguration of the entire geopolitical scene.
And, that's right.
And that is being done not in pursuit of a policy of hegemony, which has been U.S. policy pretty much since 1790. And instead of abandoning that in favor of an acknowledgement of the fact that the world is multipolar and that there are natural conditions that militate towards this configuration of political forces here and there, like the proximate location of oil reserves and markets, from Russia to Central Europe, or the relationship of goods and materials that are in Northern Korea that might go into a factory in Southern Korea, et cetera. And if you strip off the expense of this massive military machine whose purpose is to enforce hegemony, and then if you take a look at the configuration of forces among the bourgeoisie and how it's so heavily weighted towards finance and away from production in the West, and you reconfigure those things, there are a lot of people who are powerful that economically now that could do much better. And politically, you can enhance the condition of billions of people to in a way that you build a political constituency that could postpone the end of capitalism, or maybe the end of civilization, for a century or two. And so there's got to be some people that are looking at it like that. Yeah, okay, Trump, when he says Workers' Party, he's not a socialist, and they are not looking to share power with the working class. What they're looking to do is change things so they can afford to buy them off like they did in the 50s or whatever. You know, if you could do what was done to the American working class, removing the racist component and, let people buy houses in the suburbs and all the things that were funded in the post-war period for, the half of humanity that still needs these things, you're going to find an awful lot of support for whatever order is delivering that.
Well, let me say this. This is very interesting. You know, I see Trump not as the new Hitler or new Mussolini or the new neo-fascist.
Right.
In most, if you look at the political configuration of his ideas, he is very similar to the German Christian Democratic Party.
Mm.
You know, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, up to the 80s. That's number one. The other thing is Trump's policies represent imperial retreat.
Yes.
If you don't understand that, that's ABCs of political analysis at this time.
Right.
The third thing, and I want to go back to this, We live in the United States under the most brutal form of the dictatorship of finance capital.
Yep.
That is why it is a mistake of unbelievable dimensions, proportions, to call Trump a fascist. He is not. Fascism, if you want to use that language, and I don't know that it is even appropriate to this moment.
Right.
But authoritarian or dictatorial rule of all facets of the economy, culture, the society, and on and on and on, politics, is pretty much in the hands of a tiny group of people who control the financial system and hence the entire economy.
Yep.
We are under the most brutal form of the dictatorship of finance capital. And without understanding the class dictatorship, I mean, no right. one who claims to be radical has a right to talk about individual fascists. No, this is not an individual matter.
Right.
This is a matter of the class dictatorship.
That's right.
The fourth point I would like to make. This is a transitional moment in human history.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese understand it. Xi Jinping understands it clearly. And in a lot of ways, when the 19th Congress of the Communist Party of China declared the thought of Xi Jinping or the policies of Xi Jinping on par with Mao and Deng Xiaoping, what they are saying in effect is that the thought of the party at this moment sees the future, the moment and the future, as a moment and a period of historic transition, not just from one hegemon or unipolar world to a multipolar world, and not just from an Atlanticist focus center of global power to the Pacific, but what they are also talking about is the transition from capitalism and imperialism to socialism. It will not be the same in all countries. It will not be the same in all continents. Everybody will not come along at the same pace. But what the thought of Xi Jinping says, that the period of Deng Xiaoping, which was a kind of what you might call, what the Bolsheviks called the new economic policy, recovering from war and the destruction of revolution and counter-revolution, that period has effectively ended. And they see their society as now moving rapidly to socialism. Now, I would suggest a kind of socialism where the state and the market operate at the same time. Now, how they manage that is their problem. We can't tell them how to do that. But what we are looking at, and I think what the most astute thinkers, and I find them most concentrated in the Financial Times, they're probably other places, but I don't read enough languages. What the astute commentators are saying, be they in socialist aspiring China or Russia rebuilding from the devastation of the collapse of the Soviet Union, North and South Korea, and especially North Korea's idea of unification and socialism, what they're all saying, and even in the Financial Times again, is that this is a transitional period. The world will never be the same again.
Right.
All of the howling on CNN and in the in the New York Times and Washington Post, notwithstanding, these are people blinded by their privilege, by their class interest. The world is now in a transition away from what has dominated the world since World War II. Certainly since Reagan made the statement to Gorbachev Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall, meaning give the West the right to determine the history and future of your country. That is all done. It's finished. We're in a new moment in history. Trump, who was claimed to be a dunce and an idiot, he perhaps is one of the most astute actors on the political stage in the United States. He realizes that without imperial retreat, the United States will have but one option, because the people will demand it. It will be capitalism or socialism. The people with pitchforks in hand, or the modern day equivalent of it, will march on the government, will take it down state by state, city by city, unless the people have the opportunity to economically recover from what was not supposed to ever happen again. Right. Another 1930s type depression, 2008, 2009, and continuing up to this point.
Yeah, you've seen exactly that unfolding over the last three or four decades in the United States and Western Europe and in Japan and in South Korea with on different curves because of the levels of development and the shifting of manufacturing and such, but the same dynamic affecting with ending up with a shrinking middle class, an impoverished working class, and the growth of both of those conditions on the horizon for as far as you can see.
If I could just put a little drama on that idea of a shrinking middle class, you could also this is the process that Marxists and Leninists and radicals spoke about in the start of the 20th century, the pushing of the middle class into the working class.
That's right.
Ruining the petty bourgeoisie, pushing them towards homelessness and poverty.
That's not just
towards the stable working class, but towards poverty.
That's right.
This is a huge issue. When you get PhDs living in their cars, living off of food stamps,
well,
people highly educated.
When you take a taxi cab from the hotel to the Republican National Convention and you start talking about politics with the cab driver and you ask him, you seem to know a lot about this. Well, yeah, I have a PhD in political science and a PhD in history. It's like your cab. He's got three PhDs.
Right.
And this is the best job that they can find. I want us to go to this because we're getting close to out of time. And this kind of frames the whole thing. We had, Trump going to NATO and to the UK and to meet with Merkel and all these other things. And then he comes back and there's all hell breaks loose back here. And quietly in the background in Johannesburg, the BRICS meet, okay? Mm. They had their 10th summit. And they issued a document, and the next BRICS is going to meeting next year is going to take place in Brazil, but this takes place in South Africa, and there's a whole side conference involving most of the African states where they're working out ways of relating to BRICS, sitting with Xi Jinping talking about the future relations between Africa and China. And here's the topics of discussion: strengthening multilateralism, reforming global governance, and addressing common challenges. That was the first listed captioned item on the statement. The next one: strengthening and consolidating BRICS cooperation in international peace and security.
Mm.
And then the closing one is BRICS partnership for global economic recovery, reform of financial and economic global governance institutions, and the fourth industrial revolution. This is, and they're doing that with the BRICS at the center of a meeting of the nations of Africa. Next year, the show goes to South America.
This is very profound.
Yep.
Especially when you consider that there is now an alternative to the IMF and World Bank, and it's called the Asian Infrastructure Bank and the BRICS Bank. The financing of industrialization and infrastructure development on the African continent, means that African nations and regions will not have to go hat in hand to the West.
Yep. And, you know, as we've discussed before, and this is something that we've seen going on in Latin America since Chavez was elected in 1998, certainly, there is a dynamic of the various countries, regardless of the political orientation of the various regimes there, moving towards regional mutual defense of their own sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And you're seeing all sorts of, you know, across the aisle kinds of alliances and agreements being made. And look, for example, China and the Philippines, you know, and look, for example, now, despite the fact that you had the coup in Brazil, Ted Temer, who has 2% and is, you know, part of the U.S. establishment of generals that ran Brazil for all those years, the actual economic benefits to Brazil of the BRICS itself and of being a central player outweigh the benefits of being a, you know, sort of a Trojan horse inside it for the U.S. Rather, they were there in the lead saying, let's build this institution into a global powerhouse and make the world itself that kind of powerhouse. Temer was saying things that Lula could have written for him, and it's out of necessity because that's what the moment demands. Well, we're out of time, Tony, so we'll pick this up next week.
Man.
Thank you, too. And, you know, you pointed out for better than 2 years now that this moment is a pretty important one in history, and we mentioned perhaps epical on a couple of occasions. I got to agree with you.
Yeah. So, and I'd like to thank you because, you know, the ideas that I have and so on, I've had the opportunity to work them out with you publicly, and I appreciate this very, very much.
Me too. I appreciate it also, and thank you very much, Tony. We'll speak with you again next week.
Take care.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Do the corporate mainstream media fuel America's cultural wars? Do they magnify political differences? It would seem so. How else could it be, as the only topic that is discussed and argued over is Donald Trump? Are journalists infected with Trump derangement syndrome? Crosstalking Trump derangement syndrome, I'm joined by my guest, Rob Taub in New York. He's a political pundit and journalist contributing to the Huffington Post. Also in New York, we have Lionel. He's a legal analyst and a news decoder at LionelMedia.com. And in Plymouth, we cross to Patrick Henningsen. He is a journalist and writer and founder of the news website, 21stCenturyWire.com. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want. Lionel, let me go to you. You're also referred to on this program as fella. My first question is here, do the corporate mainstream, you remember that program, do the corporate mainstream media, do they contribute to the cultural wars? Is it is divided and is everything as contentious as it really is, or they just magnify it for their own political purposes? Go ahead, Lionel.
Yes, no, and sometimes. The corporate, first of all, correction, my dear friend, it is not the mainstream media. It used to be the mainstream media. They used to be mainstream. They're not. This is the mainstream media. Social media, different platforms, that's mainstream. They are in an existential fight for their life. So within the particular parameters of their working environment, yes, they mix it up and people are screaming. Does the rest of the country, mainstream, heartland, mainstream America care? No. There you go, sir.
Okay, but Rob, I mean, we all get Lionel's point, but they still think of themselves as the mainstream and representing the population. What they really do is represent power, particularly on the left, I would say. But I want to stay with this magnification here, because if you watch CNN and MSNBC and then you watch Fox on the same evening, you'd think you'd be in parallel universes. I mean, you really would have a sense that both are in some kind of never-never land and having nothing to do with the world outside. Go ahead, Rob.
I was one of the token liberals on Fox, and at one point I think I made over 210 appearances on there over the course of a couple of years. They were pursuing back then, I think, more of a fair and balanced attitude. But now, well, I was always like the Washington Generals, the team that has never beaten the Harlem Globetrotters. I, you know, was going in to know that five other people were going to beat up on me. But I was allowed to voice my opinion. I don't really get that sense anymore. I sense that the people that they pick to give a liberal perspective are speaking of outrageous claims and comments and policies, and they're taking an extreme so they can say, hey, yeah, look at this kooky liberal. He's just like Bernie Sanders. Yeah. But we also have a divisive president who has created acrimony throughout the country, and we have politicians on both sides that are taking more extreme points of view, and you're going to have news shows and stations that are going to be representative of those policies and beliefs, and then those bases are going to go and watch those particular stations and channels.
Okay, Lionel doesn't agree, but I'm going to go to Patrick first here. I mean, Rob brings up a really good point. I mean, Donald Trump, by any measure, is a very contentious president. I mean, I watch all of his stadium appearances. I mean, he goes out there, okay, and his base likes it, okay. But he does give the liberal mainstream media, or this CNN, MSNBC, the people like that, he gives them a lot of cannon fodder to work with. Patrick.
Yeah, I think earlier your point, the existential crisis that the mainstream media is going through, it's not just an existential crisis, it's a financial crisis. So what you have now is they've been forced to basically run clickbait. If you're talking about broadcast television, it's one crisis after another, or one sort of Trump derangement crisis after another. With the print, with the Washington Post, I get the daily alerts every day. It's Michael Cohen said this, Michael Cohen said that, Steve Bannon's gardener heard him, you know, whatever, singing Russian in the shower. So this is the daily sort of fodder because they can't, they have to attract the audiences. They have to get the clicks. The very thing they accuse the independent media of, or the very thing they decry on social media, they themselves are the worst offenders now. So they need a crisis. This is the sort of reoccurring theme with the mainstream media.
Okay.
It's actually always been like that for many years. They need a crisis. If it's not political, it'll be the weather.
Yeah, but Patrick, let me go to Lionel, but I get what you're saying, but what about a real crisis? Because for my sensibility, Stormy Daniels isn't a crisis for me. I could care less, okay? A creepy porn lawyer, I could care less. It's in one ear, out the other. Those are minutes of my life that I will never get back. That's why I don't watch those stations here. Lionel, you were disagreeing at some point. Go ahead, jump in.
To my dear friend, the intellectually sapient Mr. Taub, I disagree in one respect. When Roger Ailes died, Fox News as we knew it died. Absolutely died. Next, with the Fox merger, even though they swear that the news division is different, you are seeing a watered-down, anodyne, saccharine version of what was once Fox at its, and you can argue about this, best and the like. With all due respect, also, my dear friend Peter, what you like has nothing to do with what these people are interested in. This is a 24/7 runaway train that you want to be runaway. You have to keep feeding the boiler, and you are pouring everything into it. You have a newsroom with 20-something, I'm sorry to say, per diem folks who have no journalistic ability, no experience in any kind of TV or whatever. They're just there to click and just feed the monster.
But
it
Lionel,
doesn't
but
matter.
Lionel,
There's
but,
no room for correction. It's
no,
a different
but
world.
Then, But the point is here, is this dividing the country? I mean, I understand how it's made and why it's made, and I understand the bottom line here. But this is dividing the country. I mean, Jim Acosta, I mean, what a disgrace to journalism, no. Okay? I mean, and they probably think he's doing a great job. Rob, you're nodding your head. Go ahead.
He's not divided.
Okay. Go ahead, Rob.
Jim Acosta is not dividing the country. I'm sorry.
It's all right, Lionel. Go ahead, Rob.
Lionel, consider this. Okay, I'm going to start at the top with our esteemed President Donald J. Trump. When you have a White House press pool, they usually normally interact with the White House communications director, who for quite a while was Hope Hicks. The way it used to run, and I was not a huge fan of President Obama, I only voted for him once, Jen Psaki, who was a communications director, disseminated information to her comms team. The comms team then interacted with various people in the press pool and disseminated information to them so they could write about it. I don't think that's ever been done under Trump. So you have press people that sit around twiddling their thumbs, sitting and fuming, going, what am I going to do? What am I going to write about? I think I'll say that Trump is a jerk and that he's disorganized and he doesn't do anything to read, because that's what's going on
there. He doesn't need a comms team. He has Twitter, okay? That's what's happened here. Let me go to Patrick, because, you know, we've gone on
Tom.
This. Hang on. You know, we've gone back and forth on this program with all of us here about Twitter. And it's got those pluses and minuses here. But again, the traditional mainstream media, Lionel, okay, this is where that creates an opening for them as well. Okay, so, you know, these different strategies, they have their pluses and minuses. Patrick, go ahead and Plymouth.
Yeah, I think you're kind of talking about two different things here, but let's talk about social media for a minute, because these are some of the, you know, same corporations that are now overlapping with broadcast media and with mainstream print, and they are also working hand in hand with the First Draft Coalition and all these sort of confabs to police fake news and so forth. They're ideological, you know, in the United States. And, you know, their ideological dependence is really on the state, you know, and I think this is the mainstream media's problem as well. They need access to the state. They need access to power. They also need access to corporate advertising money. And hence they become a tool of government, or they become a tool of corporate propaganda. The same goes for the Silicon Valley. Facebook might be a democratic progressive in the United States, but believe me, they're absolutely colorblind internationally, because they need access to all these markets. So I guess when we're talking about media, I think we can open up the conversation now a little bit more. But in terms of United States, unfortunately, even if, as your previous guest said, they're going to be briefed by the White House team, I think they would throw that briefing in the waste bin if they received it before from the press pool received that under this administration, because they're hell for leather, really just bent on, you know, having this president impeached.
Yeah, well, that's let me go to Lionel before we go to the break here. I mean, you know, I see ideological possession. I mean, it's demonic, okay, on CNN and MSNBC. I mean, it's the point of being irrational. It's not even fun to watch anymore. I used to poke fun at it. You know, Brian Stelter, I mean, the stupidest guy on TV. But even now, that's not funny. 40 seconds, Lionel, before we go to the break.
First of all, Tom, I love you to death. I give you a kidney. Not mine, but somebody else's if you needed it. But I got to tell you two things, my friend. Number one, you're living in the past. You're living in the past. You're talking about White House news pools. What? Listen, Grandpa, wake up. And number two, you hate Trump. You can't get past it.
Okay,
you
well, Lionel, don't. You're giving us an example of ideological possession, you know. Okay. Finish.
Peter, Lionel called me kid once, and I'm 2 years older than he is.
20 seconds, Lionel. Keep going.
But it's true.
This is
new. Twitter is, look, they told FDR with the fireside chat, you can't talk on the radio. Be presidential. Need I say more? We've got to wake up and smell the coffee, kids. It's a new day.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here, guys. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Trump derangement syndrome. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, I want to go back to Rob in New York, and I want to ask you all the same question. Hypothetical. Rob, hypothetical situation. Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin media ops, they get together and they start attacking Donald Trump. How long will it take this for CNN and MSNBC to join in? All of a sudden, wow, Vladimir's on our side now, okay? I'm asking this seriously, okay? Go ahead.
What kind of attack is this going to be? Foot soldiers marching up our shores, or is it an internet attack?
All right, no, a media attack saying he's not a reliable partner. We can't work with him. We can't work with him. Okay, that's what I'm getting at. Okay, and I'm sure the left would be all over it in a heartbeat. Keep going, Rob.
No, I don't think that's going to happen. I think they're going to say, see how fickle they are, and now they've turned against Donald Trump, and this is...
Keep going, Rob.
Hypothetical. Lionel, Brian Stelter's not even going to put up for that. As long as there's a story there, we're going to milk it.
Okay, Patrick.
I think you guys are grasping at straws here.
No. I'm trying to make a point here, and it's a valid point, I think, as well. All right? Oh, come on, Lionel. Have a little bit of fun. You know, you're acting like, what was his name? Bob.
You're acting like
Senator Dole right now. Get off the grass. Okay,
Tom
Patrick.
Is so confused.
Patrick, let me go to you. Patrick. Again, what I'm just saying is that anything, no matter how bizarre and how out of the park it is, they will pick up on this, okay? Because they've picked up on every single else, real, false, imagined, and run with it like fools. They would do it again, Patrick.
So Russia versus Trump. Does that's a hypothetical, Peter. Liberals love doing hypotheticals, by the way. No, I'm just going to say yes, Peter. 100%.
Really?
100%. They would open up a shrine to Vladimir Putin outside CNN's offices in Atlanta. They would start. Rachel Maddow would go to Sochi and start doing fluff videos about what a great holiday destination it is. That's what would happen, because media is colorblind. In a sense, they'll go to where the political power is. I think they would pivot. They would definitely pivot because they want to get rid of Trump. Get rid of Trump.
Right.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
That is exactly right. That's what I'm getting at here. All right, Lionel, pretty please come out of your hole now. You can start answer the question, my friend.
He's been so convivial today.
I know. And he's in a good mood today, okay? Keep going, Lionel.
Would you take a happy pill?
Lavelle, you're a genius. First of all, you confound poor Tao, but the hypothetical? You mean it's not... What's a hypothetical? All right, listen. What you're doing is terrific. What you're saying is...
I don't have as big a vocabulary as Lionel.
Says, we... Well, that's readily apparent to anybody who's ever heard
this. This is Crosstalk, the Thesaurus edition. Okay, go ahead, Lionel.
All right.
Hit us with a polysyllabic metaphor,
please. What's another
word
for thesaurus? But I digress. Come on, please. You're chewing up my time. Now, let's assume this. So Vladimir Putin tomorrow comes out, and let's say worse than that, Lavelle, let's say he places Facebook ads. Now, imagine something that shows something negative against Trump. Now, most people would say the left, the prototypical fascist corporate left, would say, wait a minute. How can we agree with them now when we didn't like him a week ago? The enemy of my enemy is my friend. Are we going to be that craven and that venal and go along with him? Or do
Lionel,
we say, no, he's still
Lionel,
the enemy?
What to do?
That's why you're a genius.
It makes perfect sense because liberals used to believe in civil liberties 2 years ago. They don't anymore. Ask Paul Manafort, okay? I mean, for tax evasion, the average person convicted of tax evasion goes to jail for a year and a half. Paul Manafort faces 300 years, okay? What happened to liberals, okay?
They
used to believe in civil liberties.
They gave him an...
All right, hang on.
He got an ostrich coat.
I'm going to give you a hypothetical, guys.
The explanation, Lionel, is very easy. They're ideologically possessed. They've lost their marbles. Rob, give me a hypothetical.
Peter,
That
hypothetical,
too.
If Rachel Maddow went to Sochi, she would die mysteriously in some kind of biking accident. That's what would happen. They'd disappear her. Okay?
Right.
I just don't see it as a viable thing.
No, they, she'd be attacked
and you know
by
what?
Tulsa
a lot of people wouldn't be unhappy
lips.
About it.
Rachel Maddow and
hey,
Sochi, I love it.
No
I love
more hypotheticals
it.
With Tom.
I'm sorry, Patrick. Wait, it was your analogy. Back it up, okay? Go ahead, Patrick.
She could do a cameo in a Pussy Riot video, maybe, and some Cossacks are showing up and attacking
oh,
them
don't.
With whips.
But no look, pornography. Yep. No pornography. Sorry.
No comment
point,
on that
the
one.
The point is, Peter, the point is, you're right. 10 or 20 years ago, they would have rallied around the president in that scenario, but we are not in that time anymore. Now, there is a kind of a political ideological obsession, a fetish, if you will, and a total derangement to get this rid of this president. So what might have been true 20 years ago is not wouldn't happen now. In that sense, yeah, the media is completely out of its tree in that sense. But I think the point is as well that you're not going to get any political objectivity from this mainstream media. And in that sense, they're going to hand Donald Trump re-election in 2020 if they continue down this road. I think it's wishful thinking that they'll be able to impeach the president if they win the midterms. But the media is just going absolutely nuts in the run-up to the midterms with all. They're going to ramp it up, and it's just going to go nuts.
And unfortunately, but, it's yeah. kept this Russiagate nonsense going here. Go ahead, Lionel.
Peter, let me assume arguendo that I was going to ask you a hypothetical question or a rhetorical question. What's Tob's face now? But do you think these Democratic folks recognize that if for some reason, under the rules, if Trump is removed, Mike Pence is the president? Do you think their virulence.
Okay, but
that
you're,
they've ever even
Lionel,
thought about what would happen if they're successful?
You're absolutely right. But this, again, kind of confirms, I guess, what most of us are saying here and most viewers that are watching this program. They don't think these things through very well, do they? Okay? I mean, that's why it's called Trump derangement syndrome.
That was a dig at Tom, wasn't
because,
it?
Because, well, no, I mean, the thing, well, Mike Pence wouldn't bother me as
Might
president,
I interject
okay?
Here?
Please do.
Well, first of all, I'm going to kind of side with Patrick and Lionel here. The liberals have overpromised and underdelivered.
Yeah.
They've been promising impeachment. They've been promising the end of Trump every day, and people are tiring of it. And and it's beginning to make them look a little ludicrous.
Yeah.
Where is this impeachment? Where is this end of Trump that you've been telling me about for months? And I see it more than anywhere, remarkably, on Facebook with different journalists I know who shall go unnamed. That one of them always writes, cue the Jaws theme. Oh, they've been cueing the Jaws theme so much that the cello guy's fingers are probably broken by now. And it's just not it. Whether it deserves to happen or not, it's not happening soon. It hasn't happened. And they've shot themselves in the foot in that regard.
You know,
so I don't know. Is this an agreement with Lionel?
No, I think we're in broad agreement here. Patrick, the thing is that in the time from the campaign to inauguration to the present, I'm going to agree with Rob here. I mean, they've always looked for the end of something, the end of Trump, the end of this administration, you know, impeachment. But because they're so focused on that, they haven't thought about anything else to run on. And so they're going to run on hating Trump. And if you look at the public opinion polls, I mean, what is it? 88% of Republicans are staying with the president. You know, after, you know, 98% of the airwaves, a barrage against one man. I've never seen it in my life. I mean, it's all about one man all of the time. It's really exhausting because like you, I'm a policy guy. The rest of it's just kind of light entertainment. Okay, go ahead, Patrick.
Yeah, the problem is while they're going crazy trying to come up with the latest sort of gotcha for Donald Trump, and there's multiple storylines every day that are being invented along those lines. While they're doing all that, the world's turning, Peter.
Yep.
The world
yep.
is moving on. The United States has business to do as a country, and I'll extend this. I think the mainstream media are going beyond partisanship, and so are the Democrat Party, and so are the Never Trumpers, for that matter. They're undermining the actual business of the United States. States. I can't imagine more of an unpatriotic thing. They might think that they're saving the world from a Russian invasion or something like this, but the fact of the matter is they're undermining the U.S. credibility internationally. They're keeping the U.S. from doing its business internationally and on a diplomatic level. And also on other levels internationally and international relations. So that's the real damage that I think.
Yeah, I think
you said, Peter, you said at the beginning of the show that domestic politics is shaping international politics, and they used to not be that way, and it is now, and that's really dangerous.
You know, Lionel, it's an extension of what Patrick was saying there, is that this whole obsession here, it's destroying the institution of journalism. It's destroying the faith people have in the democratic process. And it's their faith in destroying their faith, maybe even in the Democratic Party. Rob, I'd like to have you back on and talk about that. You know, this, you know, the Bernie side of it, this young woman from this Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I mean, this is a direction here. The donors are terrified. Pelosi is terrified. Schumer is terrified. And it's all because this obsession with ending the political career of a man that was duly elected. Go ahead. Finish up on the program. Finish up. Go ahead. Lionel.
Peter, let me just remind everybody, do you remember in recent history any president at his or her, well, his rally, that was ever able to invoke and inspire this frothing, frenetic excitement ever when you saw rallies? Did you ever see, one was a smooth and presidential and Obama was this and that? But this president has tapped into a sizable portion of this country that the elitist, fascistic, corporate Ted Baxter sock puppet media have never been able to compromise. It's a different game. And by the way, journalism is dead.
All right, Lionel, I got to jump in here. We could do an entire program dissecting the last three sentences you just said here. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in New York and in Plymouth. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.